Coming up on this week's show, how Janet Jackson could destroy your retro computer.
Bad news for Resident Evil fans.
And we chat to the father of desktop video, Tim Jennison.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you every Friday with our amazing friends at Bitmap Books. Now, you may have seen that the Commodore 64 celebrated its 40th anniversary recently. So what better way to celebrate that than with Commodore 64, a visual compendium, taking you on a journey through the C64's varied and colourful gaming library, starting in 1982 and then travelling forward through the decades. There's going to be new copies of that available from next month, and you can pre-order right now and check out the rest of their retro gaming books at bitmapbooks.com. And with our friends at PCBWay. Now, they offer a fully featured custom PCB prototype service with low-cost, fast turnaround quality boards, and they offer services like 3D printing and injection molding. And you know they're big supporters of the retro community, so you can get an instant quote for your project right now at PCBWay.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 342, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And welcome to our first show of September. Can't believe how quickly this year is flying by. Not long until those darker evenings, the weather gets a bit colder and we spend a lot more time indoors playing classic video games, so you know, every cloud. And of course, this podcast celebrates everything to do with classic gaming and technology, bringing you up to speed on all the big happenings in the world of retro from over the last week. And we bring you a special guest on each week's show. Now, even though we describe ourselves as a retro gaming podcast, we do like to think that we talk about a bit more than just gaming.
Yeah, we love to talk about retro tech, and oh my God, this week, you know, you guys, you video edit these days with ease on your phone. You can do it on YouTube and, you know, you can just do it on your desktop. But without this guy this week, Tim Jennison, you wouldn't have been able to do that. And he has a great connection with the Amiga computer, and it kind of, he was the father of desktop video, and the hardware that he invented helped define the machine as not just a gaming machine, as a serious machine.
Well, I've got in my hand here, and I fished this out before we started recording, an issue of Amiga Format magazine. I remember vividly picking this up because, you know, I've mentioned on the show before that when I was at school, when I was at primary school, I was the computer monitor at school. So I used to, you know, in
such
the morning.
Such a cool dude.
get early and take all the BBC micros out the safe and the Acorn Archimedes and set them up. And then when I went to secondary school, I was in the AV club, after school video club. So, you know, yeah, very, very popular guy, as you can imagine, Joe. Everyone would be me. But we also used to go to film and video festivals.
Yeah.
And I remember we went with one of our teachers took us to Bradford to the
Moving Image film and Video Club.
That's the one, yeah. We saw the first IMAX screen there, and we entered one of our films that we made at school into this competition. But I remember buying this issue of Amiga Format in 1993 to read on the train from W.H. Smith. And the teacher went with us, obviously he was really into video, and I was showing him this, because the cover was The Video Toaster. Mm. And we're flicking through it. And he'd never heard of anything like this before. And he said, well, you can do that kind of thing on a home computer. And I remember reading about this thing and The Video Toaster, which, you know, Ravi will give us the explanation of exactly what it is, because it sounds a bit weird. But it was responsible for a lot of early CGI as well. So not only did television programs like MTV use it for those, you know, those wacky wipes where you'd see the corner of the screen peel away, or it'd curl away and fly off the screen, that kind of thing. But then later on, programs like Babylon 5, and they used it for affordable CGI. So if you remember Babylon 5, those, what looked really impressive at the time, those out of space scenes, you know, we'd see the spaceships flying around and everything. All of that was made using a video toaster device on an Amiga computer. Now, I know that our podcast doesn't necessarily just appeal to computer fans. We've got a lot of people just like, you know, Sega or Nintendo, for example. Like Joe, he could tell you how many levels are in probably every Sonic game. He could tell you how many buttons are on a Mega Drive controller. You probably couldn't tell the back end of an Amstrad from the back end of a horse, though.
Nah.
You're not a computer guy, Joe, if we're honest. So, I mean, for our audience, you know, hardcore console fans, explain what the video toaster is, Ravi.
Okay, so if you wanted to edit a video back in the days, you would either have to send it off to a company to do it, or you'd have to buy thousands and thousands of pounds worth of specialist hardware. Mm-hmm. So you'd basically have to have these huge devices and to edit that in broadcast quality as well, which, you know, meant you could go straight onto the television, was a very hard trick. So what they invented at this company called NewTek was a card that went into your Amiga, and it meant you could edit on your Amiga video, but you could also do those wipes, which are the transitions between stuff, so you know where it changes. You could also add CGI into there, and this was the first time that it could get to the consumer, and you know, people got their hands on it, and a lot of people created their own film reels with it. People did job interviews with it where they you know, show their work and stuff. And before, people didn't have
screen
access
swiping
to this technology.
Or whatever it's called. Like a PowerPoint, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And the thing about the video toaster was it was cool. Like, if you saw Wayne's World, Garth was wearing a video toaster top. You know, it got this reputation as being really cool. So people working within NewTek were, you know, Will Wheaton, who was a Wesley Crusher off Star Trek at the time. They also had Penn and Teller promoting it. Tony Hawk's the skateboarder used to do his skateboarding videos in there. So as he was doing, you know, a jump on the vert ramp, he'd have like a cool transition of a skateboarder spinning around. And it had that real kind of cool 90s look. But it was really groundbreaking. And it was done specifically using hardware tricks in the Amiga, because the Amiga itself couldn't play back video. You had to have them playing on external kind of video players and then edit it that way, like as you went along. But it was a really amazing piece of hardware and groundbreaking. And it just had a weird name as well, which made it really cool as well. The Video Toaster, which
we do ask about, actually, because I've wondered that for like 30 years where that name came from. So we find out with Tim when he talks to us. But you're right, 'cause I mean, before that, I remember hearing about, you know, there were machines like the Quantel paint box that, you know, the BBC used to use and everything. But these were, and, you know, Silicon Graphics machines. But you're talking machines that could range from like $50,000 to like $250,000. These things were very expensive. But when the Video Toaster came out, you could buy an Amiga 4000 for like, you know, £1,500, get this card for like $1,000. And for a studio to be able to afford that kind of technology for like, you know, $2,000 or $3,000, it was really game-changing. So it's something I've always been interested in. Something that was much more prevalent in America, because we never got an official kind of PAL version of the Video Toaster, even though there have been, you know, some kind of hacks for it over the years.
You know, when I went over to America, I was in Atlanta, and Atlanta hosted the Olympics, and there was a lot of Amiga guys out there that had actually used Video Toasters on the Olympics footage. So they were broadcasting out to TV, doing all the transitions with this kind of cheap hardware during the Olympics, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, so it's a really interesting chat. And if, like me, I mean, you kind of read about the Video Toaster back in the day and always kind of wondered, you know, exactly what it was and how it worked and what the story was behind it, you're going to really enjoy this week's chat with Tim Jennison, who actually, Penn and Teller made a movie all about him, didn't they, a couple of years ago, which is Tim's Vermeer, which is quite interesting if you want to find out more about what a legend he was. And he's been inducted into Halls of Fame, you know, been called the father of desktop video, which is really what he is. So NewTek founder Tim Jennison is going to be our special guest, and he'll be on the show in around half an hour from now. Now, before that, of course, we'd like to update you on the big stories from the world of retro from over the last week. And while we're talking about video and films and TV, this is some news that I've seen everywhere. I mean, it doesn't feel 5 minutes ago that we were talking about a Resident Evil TV series coming to Netflix. And it turns out after one season, it's been canned.
Yeah. I'm trying to figure out if I've said much about this across our socials and on the show and stuff like that. But
you mentioned it when it first started. You said you watched the first episode and you didn't want to give any spoilers, I think.
But you also said you weren't a fan. That's why I remember that.
I want to say it got better. it got better in many ways, but it got worse in many other ways as well. But yeah, it came out about a month ago now, and Netflix have canned it. They've announced they won't be going ahead with it. I say unfortunately. I guess unfortunate for the people who worked on the show, if you will. You know, I always kind of feel bad for those kind of things. But unfortunately, it does have a audience score of 27% on Rotten Tomatoes, and it's coming in around about 3 out of 10 on IMDb. And it hasn't been particularly popular with the Resident Evil fan base. As I've mentioned before, I'm in a lot of the forums and groups and stuff. If you want to take it for what it is, as just like a zombie show, and kind of take the Resident Evil element out of it, then it could have been all right. But it's so far removed from Resident Evil, it's insane. They really tried to kind of link it back with Resident Evil, and a few friends of mine who are kind of casual Resident Evil players, you know, have played some of the games. I like, oh, they link it in with the story, but like with the Resident Evil story, and it kind of, as it goes on, the show kind of reveals that it's a side-along story set in the world of Resident Evil, if that makes sense. And I don't want to spoil it, but one or two of the characters who you think are main characters from the Resident Evil franchise turn out they're not quite who they seem to be. And it, you know, it just seems they're kind of like, they were just trying to use the name, but there's just so much of it that just they got wrong. So like straight away, that kind of got my back up. I would have watched the second season, but it was a real chore to get through.
I've got a question, Joe. Like, you know, you're our resident Evil fan. Is it one of the video games that's probably had the most adaptions that go onto film or TV? Or is it because you talk about it so much?
It must be. Like, so, you know, I think there's 7, maybe 6 Resident Evil films from the first Resident Evil kind of film franchise that Paul W.S. Anderson did, you know, the guy who did the Mortal Kombat film.
Yeah.
And they did Event Horizon, and they did Resident Evil with Mila Jovovich. I think there were 6 or 7 of them that kind of ran from like 2002 to like 2017, 2016. And they're like first two kind of follow the story of the first couple of Resident Evil games. And then they just become completely mindless action films where they just use some of the characters from Resident Evil games.
So would you say it's like the kind of Need for Speed series now? Or like, would you also say, is there anything that's really hit? Has there been like a Resident Evil film that's totally cracked it? Or TV series?
The first film that has its fans, and maybe the second film has its fans for sure. And it kind of follows the story a little bit. But, you know, once again, there's lots of inaccuracies and lots of characters renamed and changed and for plot points and stuff like that. But yeah, there's been like, I want to say, and then, yeah, so I think maybe 6 or 7 in the Mila Jovovich series. And then there was another one called Welcome to Raccoon City, which came out the back end of last year, which was okay. But let's say I took you to the cinema to see it, Ravi, you would have had absolutely no idea what was going on because it just assumed you know what everything is, including particular monsters that popped up in the film. And characters,
for the hardcore fans,
you'd just be like, what the hell is this? Like, what's going on? And it just like took a lot of liberties and made one of the main characters an absolute idiot, and he's not an idiot in the games and stuff. And then there's quite a few CGI films which are meant to be classed as like canon, as actually part of the Resident Evil games, if that makes sense. I want to say probably about 5 or 6 of the CGI films now. And now, obviously, we've got the TV series. So I wouldn't be surprised if it is the most adapted video game series into kind of like cinematic universe, if that makes sense, because that's quite a lot I've just listed off there. But none of them are masterpieces. They're all far from masterpieces, unfortunately.
You know, I haven't watched any of this new Netflix series, and yeah, I probably won't now that it's been cancelled after one series. But I've seen a lot of complaints saying very similar things to what you just said then on Twitter, and looking at, you know, the comments on this Nintendo Life article, people are saying it kind of feels like they wanted to tell a story and they want to make like a zombie kind of show, and then they wanted a brand name to put on it for recognition, even though it wasn't really related to it. Yeah. Like they made a zombie show, generic show, and slapped the Resident Evil title on just to get viewers.
Yeah, that's how it felt. And like, they should just make an actual faithful adaptation of the first game and maybe the second game, you know, as the second season or something like that, but they've just never done it. They've just always played with the plot and just make it, you know, really silly. And the games are silly, you know, in terms of cheesiness and, you know, the campiness of it and stuff like that. I reckon you could make that serious if you really wanted to, because there was a cheesiness and kind of campiness to this as well, but it just didn't land.
I don't think anyone's going to be crying too much. This series has been cancelled, so still obviously scope for a good Resident Evil TV series, but I've got a feeling Netflix won't be making it anytime soon. It is available if you want to catch up on that first series, though, although Joe's probably give us all the highlights of it.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, sorry. Apologies for that. I hope nobody's screaming at me now.
This is really cool, though. This is Pac-Man World Repack. Now, do you remember Pac-Man World on the original PlayStation. I've got a feeling it was on the Game Boy Advance as well. Came out back in like 99, 2000.
Yeah, I remember it. I remember, I want to say maybe a little bit earlier, because it's got that early, like when everybody was trying to figure out 3D, hasn't it? Kind of feel to it, you know, around kind of Mario 64 kind of time. But I feel like you're right. I feel like it came out a little bit later, but some games were still trying to figure it out, weren't they? Some, you know, publishers and stuff like that. But I remember it being quite fun.
He always freaks me out. He always freaks me out, that 3D Pac-Man. I don't know why. There's something that looks wrong.
Maybe it's his Pac-Man eyes. His eyes are Pac-Man.
Or his boots and gloves.
His dead dark eyes.
Yeah.
Well, this was, really, you know, Pac-Man made into, you could say, it was a bit of a puzzle game, bit of a maze game, kind of elements of stuff like, you know, Mario 64, I guess, bit of free roaming in there too, a bit of platforming. I enjoyed this game. I haven't played it for a while, but now it turns out they've actually done a remake of it that you can play on modern consoles, including Steam. It's on there. It's on the Switch as well. And this is called Pac-Man World Repack. And they've actually made some quite nice improvements looking at this. I mean, there's an article here on Nintendo Life where they're saying that, you know, the graphics are souped up and everything, but it still kind of retains that late 90s kind of early 3D clunkiness, which some people might not like.
I was going to say, I quite like that they haven't taken away that clunkiness and quite like that sometimes it kind of gives you that original kind of video game difficulty feel. It's your fault if you died. Not so much, you know, because the controls might feel clunky, but they do what they have to do. Like, the game doesn't hold your hand, if that makes sense. Like, when they've got that kind of feel to it. It's been reviewed quite well. It's been out for a couple, at the point of recording this, it's been out for a few days. But it's really gone under my radar. I didn't know they were redoing this or anything like, you know, anything like that, because it wasn't a huge game, but obviously Pac-Man is a huge IP. But what I do like is they've done it in the vein of like the Crash Bandicoot remasters and the Spyro the Dragon remaster, where it isn't just an upscale of the original game. It's a complete rebuild of the game, but with the same feel and controls and everything. And I think it's credit to the producers when they actually make it feel and look like the original game, even though they've actually completely rebuilt it.
Yeah, and there is on PacManFandom.com, which is like a Pac-Man Wikipedia page, there's a massive list of all of the changes they've made from the original Pac-Man world, and there's quite a lot in here as well, including they give Pac-Man the hover jump ability, which was in Pac-Man and the Ghostly Adventures on the 3DS, that lets him kind of hover in the air, you know, to make it easy to jump.
Okay, so they have added quite a few things then.
Yeah, and in a power pellet transforms Pac-Man into Mega Pac-Man, which makes, you know, a massive version of him, similar to Pac-Mania, in a wedge kind of form. So it looks like they've actually gone through and added quite a lot of new features in here as well. And in the original one, I remember you had to save all of the members of the Pac-Man family to finish the game. Apparently you don't have to do that now.
The Pac-Clan.
So, yeah, so you can sacrifice all the other Pac people now.
Pac-Mom's not going to make it.
And I think, you know, graphically, yeah, you can tell they've actually rebuilt a lot of this, because it looks, you know, I think the graphics look really nice.
Yeah, it does. It does look good, definitely.
And I'm thinking, for me, it's going to be, yeah, if I'm going to get this, it looks like a game that's going to be really at home on the Switch.
Yeah, absolutely. We always say that, don't we, about these remakes and remasters and stuff. It's always perfect for the Switch. It's good for that pick up and play, especially, you know, with these kind of like older, you know, remasters. Well, retro games, you know what I mean? It's nice just to jump into them, and there's no crazy story. You know, the story is Pac-Man's family's been kidnapped on his birthday. Go get them back.
Save one or two of them if you like.
Yeah, yeah. Go save a couple of them while you do some platforming puzzles. But yeah, you know, the reviews are in, and they said, you know, I think they've given it a 7 out of 10, 8 out of 10 most places. And they've kind of said, pick it up if you see it, but don't go banging on the doors of the, you know, your local game shop saying, I need Pac-Man Repack. But it's good to see it's done. It's, you know, it's ticking the right boxes.
Yeah, and a game that I think a lot of people have probably forgotten from the Pac-Man franchise. So worth a revisit, and you can play on your modern platforms. That's available now. Now, this is really cool. If you've got your original GameCube kicking around, this stealth GameCube mod allows you to play your system with any Bluetooth controller. And I love the thumbnail to this video. It's someone playing on a GameCube using a PS5 Bluetooth controller.
This looks really cool, and they've described it as a no soldering and no cut mod.
That's what we like.
Which I also like as well. So it's called the Blue Retro, and it costs $95 at the moment, up for pre-order via Laser Bear Industries, which is a really cool name. And essentially, it, it looks pretty, I want to say it looks pretty simple, but you take the GameCube apart and you essentially just replace the front board where the, I don't know if board's the right word for it, but the panel.
Yeah, the controller board.
The controller board. You replace it with the new one and it looks really similar and you just plug it in. It just plugs into what's already there in the GameCube. And essentially, it's got internet capability on there, so you can update the interface and the firmware and stuff like that on it. But as you say, it will then pretty much pair with any Bluetooth controller. So PlayStation 3, 4, 5, Xbox One, Series X and S, Switch controllers, Wii controllers, any sort of generic HID Bluetooth controllers, any of the 8-bit do controllers as well, and even Bluetooth keyboards will work on it as well, which I think is a really cool piece of tech.
It's interesting because so Dan had this device for his Amiga, which is called a Kipper 2K. And in the back, you could add a little Wi-Fi module. Mm. Now, this seems to be like standard devices that are coming out. So at the moment, these little Bluetooth modules are coming out. And it seems like this is a kind of adaption of that. It's really cool because you said it can be updated. It can do over-the-air updates as well, which is amazing through Wi-Fi. And then you can get the new features of it. But it also supports four controllers at once.
Yeah.
On the same Bluetooth, which is pretty awesome. And
I think that's a must for the GameCube because, you know, the N64 and the GameCube, they were those four-player consoles. They had the four-player.
You play Mario Kart, you need four players.
And I think if they hadn't done that, they said, oh, mod your GameCube so you can play with the Bluetooth controllers, but it's only two-player or one-player. I think it would have, I'm not saying it would have flopped, but I think people would have been a little bit disappointed in that.
It does look nice because it lines up with the ports on the GameCube's front casing. So it looks transparent, although you're looking at it, it looks like it does actually glow a little bit inside, like there's some LED lighting in there.
Yeah.
But there are slots to plug your original GameCube wired controllers in, so you can still use them as well.
Well, it says when you plug the original wired controller in, the Bluetooth will then move along to the open ports automatically. Which is pretty awesome. So, you know, you plug player one in and then Bluetooth switches to player two.
That's really smart. That is. Because me and Dan, we were in Norway, we were trying to play our Switch and we were really struggling to get...
On the plane,
we were really struggling to get your controllers to pair with my Switch, weren't we? Like, for a good 20 minutes. And then to watch this, which I know it's a new technology going into the GameCube, but to simply watch the video, as you were saying that, Ravi, I saw it on the video, he literally plugs a WaveBird controller into port one and the Bluetooth automatically moves to player two. And then he plugs a wired controller into player two and it automatically, within a split second, automatically changes to player three. And I think that's absolutely amazing. The fact that that's not a built-in technology into, I mean, I could be wrong, but, you know, the faff to get those controllers to work on the Switch and then you just see this in a $95, $100, you know, mod for your GameCube, for me is just, I think that's amazing.
Well, he's also got Marco actions, which is basically like control key combos that can do certain stuff. So one powers off the GameCube remotely. So if you press left trigger, right trigger and start and the down button, then it will actually power down the GameCube. So there may be more functions that will get added into that with updates, which is pretty awesome. So you'll be able to do these mad key combos to do different stuff with your GameCube using this device. Pretty awesome, to be honest.
Although Joe did mention something, and I'll be honest, when playing my GameCube, you'll have to prize my WaveBird controller out of my cold, dead fingers.
Oh, really?
I still think that is like one of the best wireless controllers I've ever used.
Yeah, it is good. And it does say in the description of this that like the WaveBird is loved by many, many people. Like a lot of people really do love the WaveBird and the feel of the GameCube controller. But if you never manage to get a hold of a WaveBird or, you know, you just want something a little bit more of a modern update, then this could be the one for you.
Well, there's another killer feature as well, which is you can actually do button mapping off your phone or on a computer. So you can reconfigure the buttons on the fly, which is just like amazing. It seems like a lot of thought has been put into this device.
I could just imagine Dan having this mod and being drunk on a Saturday night playing it and he's losing it a game and he's like, let me just remap my buttons for a second.
Are you suggesting I blame the hardware rather than my gaming skills, Joe? Yeah, it does look very cool, then. I think, you know, because Wavebirds have been looking on eBay, they go for at least £70 unboxed, it seems. Oh, wow. So, yeah, and a lot of them haven't even got the... Because you need a little dongle that you plug in, you know, Wi-Fi dongle, a wireless...
Yeah, it's like a radio wave dongle, isn't it, you need?
Yeah, a lot of them are missing those on eBay, it seems, as well. So, yeah, if you don't want to pay those extortionate prices and you want to have some four-player Mario Kart Double Dash action on your GameCube, could be a really good way of doing it. So pre-orders for those look like they're available now. Yeah, we had a great patrons hangout of the weekend, didn't we? It was, and there's obviously another one coming up very soon as well. This is where we all get together, we completely geek out on the last Sunday of every month. Just a bit of a geek out session, few mates all together, talking about what games we've been playing recently, showing off hardware. That always happens as well. And just really, I mean, it's the best Sunday of the month for me when our patrons hangout's on.
Oh God, yeah, absolutely. We've kind of got into a routine now. Like you say, we do it on the last Sunday of the month. And we also do our After Hours podcast. So we kind of record our After Hours podcast and then we go straight into the hangout. And it's just so cool. You guys were really geeking out about some Mac stuff, which was just well over my head.
There's always a section where Joe's just kind of staring into space as we get really confused. Yeah.
He's on eBay spending money.
Amuse on eBay spending money. But prior to that, you guys were having a really cool conversation. You were all showing off your joysticks and everybody was discussing discussing their Amiga joysticks. And, you know, it's that kind of like user group. I can't remember who it was, but I think it might have been James who was on there, and he had a particular joystick that only had two settings on it. Somebody else had the same joystick, but it had three settings. And then Dan, you were like, oh, that's because you've got this model and you've got that model. And, you know, it's that like user groupness of it, you know, which I really, really love.
Yeah, and you mentioned the After Hours podcast, which if you join us on Patreon this weekend, very good time for gold members and above, you'll actually get the latest episode of the After Hours podcast, which has just dropped. And this time, we played games suggested by our patrons. So this was so much fun. I think you came up with this idea, Joe, that, you know, get us out of our comfort zone a little bit. Maybe get on platforms that we don't normally play games on. Maybe some like famous titles that we just have overlooked and haven't played. So we played, I think it was 9 games in total, didn't we?
Yeah, we all did 3 each. And it's really cool just to kind of like play some of the games, like you say, that could be hidden gems to us, you know. And I don't want to spoil it, but the games that I got told to play, one of them I initially hated, but after 20 minutes in, I found myself absolutely gripped to it. And now I keep thinking about going back and carrying on with it. So it was a real cool learning curve for me to sit down and actually play like some DOS games and some Amiga games and stuff like that.
We got you on Dizzy.
You did get me on Dizzy.
Everyone said, Joe's got to play Dizzy. You never played a Dizzy game.
You did get me on Dizzy. And I really enjoyed it, but I don't want to spoil it.
Yeah, so if you want to hear our thoughts on that and our reviews of games suggested by our patrons, and you can even contribute to that thread as well. You know, I'm going to keep this going a bit longer. So if you've got any, maybe your favourite game growing up that was a bit of a hidden treasure you think we should play, we'd love to review it on the After Hours podcast. So you can get access to that now. And of course, join us this month for the September Patrons Hangout. If you join us on Patreon right now, all the details are at theretrohour.com. And of course, for joining us on there, you will get a mention in the most prestigious high score table in the world of retro gaming,
Hall of Fame,
and that is the Retro Hour Hall of Fame. And we've got a brand new patron to welcome this week. A massive thank you to Damian Smith. Really appreciate your support, mate. And if you'd like to join the Retro Hour patron community, all the details are at theretrohour.com. Now, someone who probably wouldn't be welcome in the Retro Hour patron community or at one of our hangouts, you know, we think we'd have a bit of a go at her, Janet Jackson, who it turns out is destroying our old PCs.
I thought this story was pretty funny. So this is all about Rhythm Nation by
one of my favorite Janet Jackson songs.
This is where my Michael impression's going to come out. Hey, Janet.
I'm not doing a Janet impression, Beth.
I've got a new thing you should do. It's called military. And then apparently he suggested...
God's sake.
He suggested... the kind of military vibe, and then she did Rhythm Nation, which was a really cool kind of one. So this tune was on Michael. But what actually happens is in Rhythm Nation, there's a certain frequency that interferes with old hard drives that are running at a certain speed. And it's really quite interesting. I've heard about this and I've seen videos on YouTube. There was even one in America, Australia, where they were kind of holding up, you know, their laptops to Rhythm Nation and trying to get it to crash. And it's like, it's got to be a very specific model, you know, of hard drive that this is going to happen on. But this isn't the only case of this happening. So previously, there was an engineer at Sun Fishworks, and his name's Brendan Gregg. He decided to do a test, which was how to kind of upset your hard drives. And what he did was he had a stack of hard drives in a data center, and he just screamed at them. He
did like a metal growl, didn't
he? Yeah, like, and it basically caused some interference. And this is because the sectors in a hard drive are really crushed together, really close. And these like vibrations or any kind of changes in the atmosphere can affect them in a way and cause like latency on the IO, which is, it's pretty amazing. And the reason we know about this is because it's been confirmed by a Microsoft software engineer. So he actually confirmed that, you know, Rhythm Nation was actually affecting hard drives, which I think is pretty crazy. It's not just a rumor. It actually happens.
It's kind of, because I've watched a really good video on it by Dave Plummer, who does Dave's Garage on YouTube, and he's also a retired Microsoft engineer. He did like a long, like half an hour video explaining it all, and he actually tried it. He couldn't replicate it, unfortunately, but I think it's because you're right, it's got to be like a 5400 RPM hard disk of a certain vintage, and they've got more protection than that these days. But he made a good comparison. He said it's kind of like when you see, you know, like an opera singer can hold a wine glass up and they'll like hit a certain frequency and it'll shatter.
Yeah. Mm.
It'll be like that, yeah, that those kind of, yeah, getting those frequencies
it's causing
to
like
resonate
a little bounce, or it's causing like a change in the atmosphere that kind of messes it up. But it does remind me of, we did a story ages ago about you know, bits getting flipped on a hard disk through a solar rays, and somebody managed to kind of do an amazing speed run because a solar ray hit their hard drive. So it's amazing how many things can actually affect hard drives, you know, natural causes and stuff like that. I'm pretty mad, to be honest.
That guy doing the metal growl in the data center, I thought was pretty cool. I just got this vision, because obviously, Joe, you know, you've been in several metal bands over the years. I've got this vision of you now being banned from like Play Expo. So you're going to walk around and destroy all the old computers.
Just
and
screaming at old computers. Yeah.
I won't do that, don't worry.
Don't let him into a data center.
Yeah, stay well away. So if you want to see the videos as well, I'll put Dave's video in the description as well. It's a really good watch. So yeah, keep Janet Jackson away from your old PCs if you want them to keep functioning. Now, what about this? A classic game publisher, Sunsoft, is back. Now, remember Sunsoft from games like Blaster Master, Batman, and lots more as well. Turns out it's actually reviving its retro back catalogue.
Yeah, in the late 80s and early 90s, Sunsoft did a lot of like Nintendo and Sega licensed games, didn't they? That was kind of like what I remember them for.
Festus Quest,
yeah. They did a lot of those kind of like, you know, big franchise kind of licensed games. A lot of the good ones, you know, like you say, Batman, stuff like that. And then obviously Master Blaster, which is an absolutely amazing game. But they've not been around for a while, but they are still around. Like their parent company is still going as like a technology company, but Sunsoft haven't been, you know, they haven't been game publishers for a while. But last Thursday, which was the 25th, they did actually announce 25th of August that they were returning to game publishing. And essentially the reason behind it, which comes from, they're a Japanese company, so I'm going to butcher a lot of names here, and really sorry about this, Yuichi Ouchi, I think his name is the general manager of Sunsoft. And essentially he's announced that they're coming back simply because they're doing very well at the moment. The company's doing well, and they kind of want to dip their toes back into the into the gaming world and publishing. So they've hinted that they're going to be bringing back a lot of those kind of licensed games, and that we may see them updated or re-released for modern consoles, which would be really, really cool.
I think the last releases they did were WiiWare ones. And
were they?
Stuff for the like virtual console. So they were kind there of like re-releases and stuff.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
That was a while ago, you know. That was 10 years ago, really.
10, 15 years ago
15,
now.
Yeah.
So, you know, they've hinted that they're going to be bringing a lot of these NES and, you know, Sega Genesis Mega Drive classics back, including hinting towards Aero the Acrobat, who was, you know, one of the... I'm going to say it wrong now. Anthropomorphic. I can't say it, but he was a bat person, you know, in the heyday of Sonic. You know, they've hinted towards bringing him back, which is really cool. But they have announced a couple of games which did only come out in Japan and never made their way to the West, you know, back in the day. And they have announced that these games are being remastered and re-released for modern consoles, so Xbox, Switch, PlayStation. So the big one they're coming out is Ikki Unite, which is a sequel to Ikki, which was a game that came out in the 80s. I have never heard of it.
No, was that Japanese only?
It was a Japanese only game. And they're also bringing back Gimmick and Euphoria, which are all Japanese only games. So unfortunately, I'm not familiar with any of these games, but they're bringing out remasters and sequels to these games, and they're hoping that these will do well. And then essentially, they will then kind of look at their back catalogue, which I think would be really cool if we saw remasters of Blaster Master and, you know, like say Batman.
Well, there's another one as well that you were playing on the After Hours, which was Phantom 2040 as well.
Oh, is that by Sunsoft as well?
Yeah, it looks like it.
Oh, wow. There we go. So
I remember Sunsoft more for the Looney Tunes games.
Yeah.
Yeah, Bugs Bunny, Rabbit Rampage, Daffy Duck they did as well. I remember my friend Martin at school loving Tasmania on the Super Nintendo, which was a Sunset game as well. I've been looking at that. Apparently these games weren't reviewed all that well.
You see, all these games, actually, these are all games I loved.
Yeah.
So
what's the thing? It's like, so I'm looking here, there's even a comment on one of these articles going, Sunsoft, kings of the 8-bit era, not so much the 16-bit era. But then, yeah, I mean, I remember a lot of kids playing the kind of Looney Tunes games that they play.
Yeah, no,
whether it was just because we watched the cartoons and stuff, and you buy anything, we're like, you know, Daffy Duck.
Daffy Duck slapped on it, you buy it, yeah.
There's a lot of kind of re-releases as well and stuff like, you know, Spy Hunter and like Fantasy Zone and stuff like that.
And apparently they also put out Lemmings on the Super Nintendo.
Oh, wow.
They did that version for Psygnosis.
There you go. So maybe they'll be bringing Lemmings back, the SNES version. who knows? But no, it's cool to see that they're like, well, we're doing well. We haven't released any games, as Ravi says, since like the virtual console on the Wii. So let's have another bash at it. And these games that they are releasing apparently were really big cult hits in Japan. They just never made it over here, but they are going to be now. Obviously, they're going to be on the game, you know, on the Microsoft Store and stuff like that. And is it PSN? And stuff. So, one to keep an eye out for, see if we can get some re-releases of the Sunsoft NES games.
It's good just to see like a dormant brand from our childhood being brought back as well. That's always going to be quite cozy to see, I think, isn't it? So, welcome back, Sunsoft. Right, then next, we're going to be chatting to the father of desktop video. If you've ever heard of a video toaster and you think, what on earth is that? How did it change the world? Well, we've got a legend who's going to be talking to us next on the Retro Hour podcast. New tech founder Tim Jennison is this week's special guest, and he's next. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time for this week's very special guest. Now, I've got to say, as a kid, when I used to read, you know, about stuff like the video toaster in magazines, I used to look at that and drool over it. I mean, we talk about the Amiga on this podcast generally from a gaming perspective, but the fact that it was used with this incredible device for visuals in programs like Sequest and Babylon 5, stuff like that, just incredible. It blew my mind as a kid. So today, we're actually joined by someone who's been described as the father of desktop video, and that is Tim Jennison. Welcome to the show, Tim.
Hey, thanks.
Really appreciate you coming on and sharing some of your memories with us today. Now, before we get into the video toaster and new tech, I mean, it's always nice to kind of get a bit of background on our guests. What was kind of your first experience of seeing computer graphics and combined with film?
Well, I was a kind of a film nerd. As a youngster, I made 8mm home movies. I had a dark room. I would take magazines like Cinefex and I would pore over them with a magnifying glass, trying to figure out what was going on. But then as, you know, mini computers, micro computers arrived in the late 70s, I was there. You know, in the magazines, you'd see this thing called ray tracing, demonstrations of the software that made highly realistic computer-generated imagery, and I thought that was the most exciting thing in the world. But I was also a video guy early on. I had, back in the early days, the video recorders were reel-to-reel, and they did black and white. So I'm talking about the Sony CV series. And they had a so-called port-a-pack where you could put it over your shoulder and go out and shoot black and white stuff. So I was doing that sort of thing. But then, you know, the thought just naturally occurred to me, these microcomputers need to be merged with these video cameras. And, you know, you could see computer graphics on television, typically like on the intro of a show. They would blow their budget on this CGI, you know, three-dimensional shape rotating or something like that. But it was extremely expensive. But when the Amiga came out, I go, this is, you know, this is perfect for that merger of video and computer.
Well, we were wondering, when did you first see an Amiga? And what did you think of it when you very first see it? Did you see the prototype at all?
No. I first saw it in Byte magazine. There was a cover story on the Amiga, and I started reading it. And 4,096 colors, and Genlock adapter. So that was the magic word. That meant that this computer could sync up to a standard video signal, and that's what made the whole Video Toaster possible.
What about NewTek, the company? Then when did you found that, and why did you form the company?
Let's see, what year was it? It was around 1986. I had been involved in the Tandy color computer. Now, the Tandy color computer was also a standard video signal, RS-170A, so NTSC video. And I had made a video digitizer for that computer, which was called the DS-69, which I sold to a company called MicroWorks. And it was a real-time video digitizer, which was pretty remarkable for that computer. The computer, you know, ran at less than 1 megahertz clock speed. But it, like I said, it did put out a standard video signal. I wrote a paint program for that computer called Coco Max. They call that computer the Coco, short for color computer. And the Coco Max program was sort of a clone of Mac Paint, which had just basically the Mac came out. And within 6 months, I sort of cloned their paint program. So that, you know, I already had some experience with video applications. I made a character generator and a couple of other things for the color computer. And when the Amiga came out, I went to my partners at Colorware in New York, and I said, "Look, we got to jump on this Amiga thing. This is a perfect computer for doing video." And my partners, Jack and John, they said, "Well, I'm not sure that's a big market." Video production. And I said, "Well, gosh, I do." And what are we going to do about this? And they said, "Well, you know, maybe it's time we part ways." And I said, "Okay." And it was highly amicable. They said, "Look, we'll buy your shares of the company from you, and you can go off and start your own thing." So I did. I, you know, called it NewTek. And the first product that I had in mind was DigiView, which is a slow scan digitizer, unlike the real-time one I had on the color computer. But it was very low cost, and I figured out how to do color from a black and white camera. So color cameras were not that common, believe it or not. Video cameras, most of them are black and white, you know, like a cheap security camera. So I figured out this way to put a red, green, and blue filter on a wheel in front of the camera lens. And by taking three different exposures through the three different color wheels, you could make a color image. I made a demo reel that showed, I don't know, three or four, no, I think six. It showed six different images. You would just put it in the Amiga and run the program, and it would cycle through these six images with a crossfade or dip to black in between each one. I put this demo on a diskette and went to this Commodore function nearby where they were introducing the Amiga computer, and I handed it to a Commodore guy named Jeff Bruett after the show. He put it in the computer, and he said, "Oh, interesting." interesting. Can I make a copy of this? I said, yeah, but please don't spread it around because my phone number is in the README file. He said, okay, I won't give it to anybody. And, you know, within days, my phone was ringing off the wall. And I knew we had a hit, and it was, you know, extremely popular. And then for our follow-on, DigiPaint was our second major product. And I worked with a programmer named Jamie Perdon on that. It was unusual because it used the hold and modify mode on the Amiga, which is extremely difficult to work with, but gives you the most colors, 4,096 colors on the screen. So, I don't know, a year or two after DigiView, DigiPaint came out, and it was very successful. And, of course, this was all leading up to the Video Toaster. So, I was in a meeting at NewTek, and I had a long list that I'd cobbled together of possible projects we could do on the Amiga computer, including some games that were video heavy. And one I called the Video Black Box, which was a special effects unit. And it also on the list were things like a character generator and so on, 3D program. It was early days. We could do anything we wanted on the Amiga computer. And, you know, the Amiga was the computer from the future. It just wasn't possible to do these sorts of things on a Mac or a PC. So we got to this black box idea, and I started to describe it. And the other people in the meeting started asking me a lot of questions. So could you make the video like rotate and page peel and stuff like that? And I said, well, in theory, yeah. Let's do that. Because, you know, they were all kind of video fans. You know, that kind of performance was just not possible. You had to pay $20,000 or $30,000 to get a special effects unit that would do that. So we started on that. And then as time went by, and time did go by, and people started to say, hey, is that video thing vaporware? And what happened was we decided to incorporate several other items from that list right into the Video Toaster. So we threw in the character generator. We threw in the 3D animation system. We threw in a paint program. And we realized that this really needed to be a collection of tools. And, you know, finally we finished it and got it out the door in, I think it was 1991.
And I remember reading in magazines and actually seeing demonstrations on television of the Video Toaster. And even the presenters on TV on, you know, computer shows over here would often be like, yeah, this is actually running on an Amiga, you know, that machine that you play games on at home. And it was, you know, just crazy to me that this machine that I was playing Lemmings on could do that. What was Commodore's reaction to the Video Toaster? And were they behind the project? And did they give you much support?
You know, they gave us all the support we needed. When I got my first Amiga, you know, the first one in town, I went to the computer store, the Commodore store, and said, I want the first one, you know. They obliged. It came with documentation, which was strange. It came with all these software developer handbooks. Great. But I got to a point where I didn't have enough information about what was under the hood, the hardware. And so I Commodore was not forthcoming on that, but I got a hold of some ex-Commodore people, and they suggested that a couple names that I could try to approach inside Commodore. And I did. These were guys in the Los Gatos development team. So the developers in Los Gatos really gave me the support I needed. It wasn't coming from corporate. But once DigiView came out, I think we rubbed some people the wrong way, maybe, because they had put their eggs in the basket of another video digitizer. And they were supporting that one and promoting that one. It, however, didn't ship for a long time. And the same thing with the Video Toaster. We started talking about that, and they had been working with the New York Institute of Technology on some video chips that would work with the Amiga computer. And I think they just sort of thought that we were not as pedigreed as NYIT, I guess.
You would originally, the Amiga 2000, which was a really big machine.
Yeah.
That was the Amiga that most people put the video toaster in. But then Commodore released a smaller high-end machine called the Amiga 3000. I remember reading at the time quite a bit of outrage from a lot of people that the video toaster wouldn't physically fit into this new high-end machine. I also thought that was a bit of a strange decision from them, you know, not to kind of consult you and work with New Tech, you know, to make sure that it did. So
yeah, we weren't especially close at that time. And, you know, the 3000 came out and we go, okay, well, we'll have to make a version of this that'll fit in the 3000.
I was wondering, like, do you think that the toaster helped Amiga's reputation kind of helped establish it more as just a gaming machine?
A lot of people told us that. I'm not sure. I mean, the video toaster itself, the name was somewhat whimsical, and broadcast network people didn't really take it seriously, possibly because of the name and because, well, they could afford that expensive stuff, I guess. But, you know, the market for the Amiga, it's a consumer machine. And for consumers, you expect sales in the millions. And the video business is just not millions of units. It's a lot of units, but not millions. So I think, you know, probably rightfully, Commodore was not really concentrating too much on professional video.
I've got to say, the name as well, Video Toaster, that always, you know, stood out. It was memorable. But where did the name come from?
Well, back in the early days of development, when it was going to be a collection of products, we envisioned several cards going into the card cage in the computer, like slices into a toaster. So it became the code name for the whole project, the toaster, we called it. It was going to be a collection of cards. Well, eventually we boiled all the cards down to one and collected all the software into one application. It came time to launch the product, and we were sitting around trying to think of a good name, which is hard to do. At the end of the meeting, it was scratching our heads. None of these are great. Well, why don't we just call it the Video Toaster? And that stuck. And it was, you know, it was whimsical, but it was also memorable, as you say. I went to Commodore headquarters, and one of the marketing guys was ex-Apple computer. And we sat down for a meeting. He says, "Now, you're going to come out with this product called the Video Toaster. That, you know, that's, I wouldn't do that if I were you. It's kind of a silly name." And I said, "Now, you're from Apple computer originally?" "Yes." "Well, isn't Apple kind of silly?" "Well, I don't know, you know." So, yeah, it was memorable, and I think that helped.
And when the product was initially kind of created, it had like keyboard overlays and stickers that you put on your machine, and it really did kind of change the identity of a machine into like a serious piece of video equipment. Was that an aim to kind of get the professional video industry excited about it?
There were certain buyers that just didn't like the idea of essentially a game computer in their control room. So there was a segment of the market that just wanted to buy a toaster, not the Amiga computer. So we talked to Commodore and said, "Would you OEM computers to us so that we could, you know, put our own branding on it and install it and sell it as a unit?" And they agreed. And that's what happened there. A lot of people still bought the Amiga separately. A lot of dealers did that for their customers. It was not the easiest thing in the world to install. So a lot of dealers sort of added value by, you know, creating a working system for their customers. And that included adding things like processor accelerators and things like that.
You mentioned earlier about those wipes that were in there as well, these, you know, transitions that a lot of TV programs would use between scenes. I mean, how important was it to get industry quality wipes, and how much of an industry was actually using wipes back then? Was it quite widespread?
Well, you know, you can, it's a matter of taste. You can overdo it, certainly. But yeah, there were, you know, vertical and horizontal wipes were quite common. I guess the second most common might be the clock wipe, which sort of spins around like a dial of a clock, and it uses, in editing, it's used to indicate the passage of time. So those are the popular ones. A page peel was quite commonly used. But the video toaster had a lot of really strange wipes. You know, we just sort of threw in the kitchen sink. So we had falling sheep, for example.
Nice.
Sheep would fall from the sky and reveal another video underneath. There were the so-called Kiki wipes, which were silhouettes of our spokesperson, Kiki Stockhammer. And she would, in silhouette, she would come up and pull down a window shade, revealing another video, for example. Those were very popular. But, you know, we just kind of threw in everything we could.
Well, so,
there was a team that their job was to come up with more wipes.
Well, talking of the kitchen sink, I remember that was actually like an add-on board from a Digital Image.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, did you see a lot of those like time-based correctors and add-ons and extra kind of products coming out? And did you kind of enjoy that?
Yeah, absolutely. And it was necessary. You know, it's mind-boggling how difficult it was to actually do tape editing back then. And if you took a stock tape machine and ran it into the video toaster, well, it wouldn't like it because it didn't really meet the timing specs of video. It would slip and slide in time. And so you had these things called time-based correctors that would fix that and make that videotape machine meet the specs. Now, you couldn't really see on screen any difference, but the toaster would accept one signal but not the other. So time-based correctors were kind of expensive. And when I talk about the dealers putting together complete systems for users, that was one of the problems that they would solve. They would set the user up with you know, the tape editing part. And there you would have typically two tape machines and an edit controller, which would control the machines. And you would work your way through the program one scene at a time, adding it on to the recorder sequentially. Very unlike the nonlinear editing that we do today, what they called assembly editing. You would start at the beginning and get to the end. So, yeah, those companies that made time-based correctors suddenly had a huge market in the video toaster users. Now, if you're doing live video with cameras, you didn't need those. But a lot of people that had toasters wanted to do tape editing. That created a market for those time-based correctors.
Well, Lightwave was a 3D rendering package that, you know, was very popular on the Amiga. And, you know, obviously we're going to talk about these shows like Babylon 5 that use a video toaster, but Lightwave was often used to, you know, design those 3D models that we'd see on television back then. How important was working with Lightwave to the toaster's success, and what was kind of the background with that product then?
When we sat down to create that list of applications, 3D was right on the list. We did not write one. We knew of some 3D programmers out there, and we approached several of them and ended up hiring Alan Hastings and Stuart Ferguson. And they created the modeler and the renderer, respectively. The modeler was basically where you would go and create your 3D models. And then the renderer was this program that would make it look realistic, photorealistic. And then you would assemble the frames one at a time onto a tape machine. When we first shipped the toaster, the Lightwave 3D didn't really make much of a splash. People would run the toaster and they would see that little 3D button. They would click on it and suddenly they're in this complex world of top, front, and side views and tools to add primitive shapes, etc. And it, to a lot of people, it just kind of looked intimidating, looked like homework, and they'd rather go back and play with the sexy stuff. As time went on, more and more toaster users would click on that thing and say, well, it's in my toaster. I guess I should try to take advantage of it somehow. And that, I think, was a kind of a Trojan horse to get a lot of video people into CGI. Then we started getting calls from people in Hollywood, movie people and television people. And one of the earliest ones was Ron Thornton, was British. He'd worked on the Doctor Who show doing practical effects. In other words, you know, building things out of parts, you know, as before computer graphics.
It was notorious for that, Doctor Who. You'd see other bits of BBC set going into Doctor Who episodes.
Right. That alien looks kind of like a vacuum cleaner for some reason. Yeah. Anyway, so Ron had been pitching this show called Babylon 5. And the concept was that he would use light wave. And he sent us a diskette in the mail. We put it in the Amiga, popped it up on the screen, and here is the Babylon 5 ship. And it's gorgeous. Ron said, our producer would like to meet with you guys to discuss the project. So Doug Netter was the big money man. And he just wanted to know that we would support the team, you know, throughout the any problems. And we promised to do that. And almost immediately, Ron was running into trouble. There was motion aliasing. So with this Babylon ship, there were tiny pinpoints of light that were the portholes of the ship. And that's kind of the worst case scenario for aliasing, because as soon as the ship started to move, these lights would fluctuate. And you have to do what's called anti-aliasing to get rid of that. And our anti-aliasing was not good enough at that point. So we sent the programmers into the back room to fix the aliasing. Another early customer was Todd Rundgren, the rock musician, who had been a video guy for a long, long time. He had a video studio in Woodstock, New York. Well, we were at a Mac show in San Francisco, showing the video toaster. And I saw this tall, long-haired person across the room. And I go, that's Todd Rundgren. He's got this unmistakable forehead. And that's Todd Rundgren's forehead walking across the room. He gets closer and closer and closer and closer. And he walks right up to me. He says, what's this? He says, the video toaster. And I knew Todd was video savvy. So I immediately went into video jargon speak and told him that it was a character generator, a still store, a 3D animation system, a video switcher, special effects generator, etc. I went down the list and I said, each one of these stations around our booth, you can get a demonstration of each part of the toaster. He said, great, thanks. And he disappeared. Well, the next morning we came in to open up the booth and Todd is there before the show opened. He's been there all night, I guess because you don't kick Todd Rundgren out. And he'd been there all night and had learned the whole thing. And he said, I'm going to need like a half a dozen of these. I said, okay, thank you. And then Todd started sending us, we didn't have email. He would send us faxes. This is early days, fax machines, look it up. And he would say, this doesn't work the way it should. I'm having trouble with this. The program crashes when I do this. And he was just like the beta tester from hell, in a good way, you know, because the programmers all wanted to make Todd happy. So all these things sort of drove the development of a Lightwave 3D and made it ready for prime time.
And that's really important, that kind of having that broadcast quality as well and being able to go out onto television. That must have impressed quite a lot of people, knowing that you could do it on a lot cheaper kit in broadcast standard.
Yep, and it actually saved the company, Lightwave, because when Commodore fell on hard times and stopped making the Amiga, fortunately, about that time, Microsoft had developed Win32, which allowed you to run 32-bit C code on the PC, which wasn't possible up to that point. So we could port Lightwave 3D at that point to other computers. The most important being the IBM PC. And at that time also, there started to be good video display cards for the PC. We kept the Amiga business going for quite a long time. There were a lot of machines out there and people kept buying them. But eventually, you know, the writing was on the wall. We had to develop on a different computer.
Well, kind of during that period, you mentioned Kiki Stockhammer as well. And I remember her as the face of the video toaster. And I was wondering how she got involved with the company and the kind of marketing, because she was throughout there, throughout into the kind of late days after the Toaster 4000. I think she even went into the TriCaster stuff as well.
Oh, yeah. She left for some period of years and then came back and promoted the TriCaster. But yeah, Kiki had gone to school for a corporate communications degree, I think. But she was working as a dental technician at the time. And one of the new techers just happened to be at the dentist and struck up a conversation with her. And she was very interested in the new tech story. And so she came in for an interview, and the rest is history. She's just a natural in front of a camera and in front of a crowd. Her first job, 2 weeks after she was hired, we were doing the Commodore show in Cologne, Germany. Kiki had to get up in front of the crowd and demonstrate the video toaster. Fortunately, Kiki speaks German fluently. Who knew? And she had a meeting out of the palm of her hand.
Well, I was wondering what the kind of changes were when you went onto the Toaster 4000. And I remember seeing the promotion for the Toaster 4000. It seemed like you had everybody in the video with Penn and Teller, Tony Hawk, Will Wheaton in that as well.
Right. Well, Will Wheaton actually worked at New Tech.
What kind of stuff was he doing there?
I'm not sure. It was marketing things. You know, I didn't work with him directly. He was in the marketing department. But it was pretty weird to walk down the hall and Wesley Crusher is coming from the other end of the hall. Don't call him Wesley, though. He didn't like that. But yeah, he was invited to one of our Christmas parties and he liked it so much he stuck around. Yeah, the 4000 demo tape we had, we sort of threw a lot of promotion behind it. And Penn and Teller were in it. I've known Penn and Teller for a long, long time. And when we were putting that tape together, I asked if Penn would appear on tape. They also did, Penn and Teller did a very early promotional tape for the video toaster called Penn and Teller's Guide to Video Toaster Etiquette. And this was quite a while before the toaster shipped. And I think if you go on YouTube, you can probably find Penn and Teller's Guide to Video Toaster Etiquette.
It'll seem like they were very tech savvy as well. Because I remember them doing some stuff with like the Sega CD when that first launched too. I mean, were they big fans of the technology and maybe their kind of background in exploration and magic maybe helped there somehow?
Yeah, they were, some of the most wired show business people you can imagine. They were early adopters of computers. Their office was computerized. They traveled a lot and then they stayed online. There was no online internet at that time. It was done through bulletin board systems, but they had their own system called the Jungle, and they would invite just a few friends and we'd have these conversations, and you had to get on and get off very quickly. You know, you wanted to download the messages and upload your new message in a minute or two because somebody else was trying to dial into the system. So that's how archaic things were back then. But they're definitely tech heads.
Well, how much did Garth wearing a video toaster t-shirt in Wayne's World help sales?
I don't know. Hard to say. But that's another interesting story. One of the engineers on the video toaster was Brad Carvey. His brother is Dana Carvey, who was one of the stars on Saturday Night Live at that time. And then went on to do Wayne's World and Wayne's World 2 with Mike Myers. So by virtue of having Brad on the toaster development team, we could occasionally hang out with Dana Carvey. Got to visit Saturday Night Live a few times. And then when they were shooting Wayne's World 2, we were invited to go on the set. And Brad said, "Hey, could you wear a video toaster t-shirt?" And his brother, Dana, said, "Well, I'll run it up the flagpole, see if anybody agrees." And so there you are. But I got to say, Mike Myers is one of the most shy people I think I've ever met. And he kind of looked at his shoes a lot. But then after the ice is broken, he's just the funniest person you can imagine.
I was wondering if there were any like really mad examples or projects or uses of the video toaster that you weren't expecting that you saw and people were doing?
Yeah. In the manual for the toaster, it said, send us your tapes. We would like to see them. Well, they did. And tapes were arriving regularly, daily. I still have all of them, by the way. And some of them are now big names that were people just trying to get started with their toaster. And you saw everything under the sun. There was, one of the more interesting and well-done ones was a bar mitzvah tape that was a multi-camera shoot and just over-the-top production. There were some job applications that were done on video. There were porn, porn drove a lot of the early video videotape business, and video toaster was adopted, I guess, because it was pretty affordable. So, yeah, I mean, we were amazed constantly at what people were doing, and it was, gratifying. And Penn, at one point, before we shipped the toaster, he said, you're going to see a lot more bad video, and you're going to see a lot more good video. You're going to see a lot more video. He said, if you can buy a pencil, you can be a writer. So writing is a true art form. But he said, you can't be an artist and make video because the tools are unaffordable. This is going to change that.
Like I mentioned before, I remember reading about the video toaster when it launched. But the magazines, I read them all and I thought, this thing looks incredible. But then it got to the end and it was like, this is an NTSC. Yes. Based device, and we're hoping there's going to be a PAL version so we can use it in Europe. What was the story with that?
Well, eventually there was a PAL version that was done by a third party who used standard converters that actually converted the PAL to NTSC, ran it through the toaster, and then output it back through another converter to PAL. And if you know anything about standards conversion, you can imagine how that did not work that well. It puts a pretty heavy fingerprint on the signal when you do that. Makes things sort of grainy and jerky. But the toaster used a kind of a dirty trick to do the video effects that really depended on NTSC. And we made a conscious decision that was going to be okay, because we thought 99% of our market was going to be in North America, and it probably was. So, when Kiki did that show in Cologne, she was very careful to say, this is not PAL, So act accordingly. It would have been nice, but like I say, we were using a quirk of the NTSC video signal to make the effects work, and it would take me a while to explain it. But like I say, it was a dirty trick. It was sort of a what we called a hack. And so hackers, there's two kinds of hackers: those that steal computer time from other people, and then there are the good hackers who use software and hardware to get the job done. And they'll do anything, break the rules to achieve the result. And so in that sense, that's what the toaster was. It started on the back of a napkin in a pizza joint. And I was describing this to Brad Carvey, and I said, if we can deal with these pixels as a collection of four pixels, we can move them anywhere on the screen and the color will be correct. We don't have to decode the signal into RGB. And that's, in a nutshell, how it started. But this would not work in PAL. Well, no, it won't. What do you think? And we decided to go ahead.
Well, the toaster flyer was amazing. I've actually seen one running in the UK recently, and just being able to make that change from playing from a video source to actually playing from hard drive, that was really huge. Was this a very popular upgrade?
Yeah, it was. At the time? And it was one of the first broadcast quality online editors. Where you could just random access. You could drag the clips around in any order you want, hit play. You could even hit play and rearrange the clips that were coming up in the next few minutes. You could basically create the show, edit the show as it was airing, which, as far as I know, is probably still a unique feature. But yeah, we knew what a hassle it was to do tape editing with all the time-based correctors and the edit controllers. And so next on our list was trying to make a nonlinear editor. Avid also had one. As far as I know, at that time, it was not possible to strictly get a broadcast quality signal out of an Avid editor. There were technical problems with the signal, but the engineers tended to overlook those because it was so powerful to do nonlinear editing so fast. So we worked on getting a video signal onto a hard drive, which was quite difficult because the hard drives didn't really pass data very fast. And video comes at you like a fire hose, data-wise. So you have to compress it, reduce the size of the data so that it'll go onto hard disks. And so the flyer was basically a giant compression board that would compress a signal and then decompress multiple streams in real time as they would go through the toaster. And it was amazing. It's one of the easiest ways to edit to this day, somewhat ahead of its time.
In 1994, obviously Commodore went bankrupt, who made the Amiga. You kind of alluded to before, the fact that you had to move to the PC. Did you kind of see the end of Commodore and the Amiga coming? And how quickly did you have to change the company to survive then? Because, it seemed like the toaster was so linked to the Amiga at that stage.
Yep, it was joined at the hip with the Amiga. We actually used the Amiga's video signal to control the toaster. The toaster was not in the regular card slots. It had no access to the computer's data and address buses. It was only in the video slot. So we were using the Amiga's video signal in a very unusual way. And we had to have the Amiga genlocked to our toaster board to do that. Well, no other computer worked that way, specifically with that video slot with genlock. And at the time we started the toaster, the Mac was black and white. It was a sealed box. You couldn't open it without the secret screwdriver. The PC could do basically 16 colors in big chunky blocks. So the Amiga was our only choice. We didn't really pay too much attention to Commodore, the company, but we should have because they were showing early signs of cracking. But it came as a shock when they went out of business and the video toaster was selling like there's no tomorrow, and then suddenly there's no tomorrow. It looked like we were dead in the water. And as I said earlier, then we ported Lightwave software to the PC and to other computers. It ran on 5 or 6 platforms, ultimately. And that kept the cache going until we could develop our video product on another platform, and we chose the PC to do that. Essentially, the approach changed because with the Amiga toaster, we had to have a lot of custom circuitry to process the video in real time. The computer itself couldn't do it. You could not digitize the video, put it in the computer, and then pull it back out. It wasn't fast enough for that. But when we started on the PC toaster, processor speeds were climbing rapidly. And I remember I was in a meeting with some of the new tech staff, and I said, look, very soon we're going to have 33 megahertz Pentium chips. One of the people in the meeting said, wait a minute, what? 33 megahertz? That's crazy. That'll take decades. And I said, no, Moore's law, all you have to do is look it up. It's going to go to 33, then 66, and eventually we'll have gigahertz. That's what we were relying on. We were relying on Moore's law. So we, early on, even though the computers weren't quite fast enough, we decided that what we needed to do was have the computer do all the work. So we had a card to digitize the video, turn it into numbers, and put it on the computer's bus, put it in the computer's memory with DMA. The computer software then would modify the picture to the extent that it could, and then quickly output that frame. So there's a bit of a delay there compared to the video toaster, but that's fine. And it allowed us to do amazing things, more and more amazing things as Moore's law ground away. And the computers got faster and faster and faster. So that was a fundamental change. And the toaster then became essentially a piece of software.
And it also kind of changed into what was really the spiritual successor to the video toaster, a product called the TriCaster as well, didn't it?
Right. So the video toaster for Windows was a card. And, you know, the same model as we used in the Amiga. And typically dealers would install it for a customer, get it all working, work out the kinks. And there was a board meeting or an executive meeting one day where I said, you know, what if we do like we did with Commodore and OEM this thing by a computer, like, for example, a small form factor shuttle computer, put our card in it, have video jacks right on the box, sell it as a turnkey system. And it was somewhat controversial, believe it or not, because we had all these dealers that had really made their mark by integrating these systems. And this would sort of take away some of that business for them. And indeed, some of the dealers did not like the idea at all. But it, in the end, it's the right idea. It makes life much simpler for the customer. And the first TriCaster just sold like hotcakes, and then we came out with more and more TriCasters after that.
I thought it was an amazing concept, and it's also kind of amazing now that you look at mobile phones and kids can sit there and edit 4K movies on the kind of fly. And looking back at those early kind of Amiga days, you must kind of feel proud of what you did with such limited technology.
Absolutely. And, the technology continues to evolve. There are bigger and bigger video toasters. And as you say, you can make video just fine on an iPhone. It's great living in the future. it's amazing what the computers can do compared to those early days.
Well, in 2013, Penn and Teller actually made a documentary film about you called Tim's Vermeer. What was the story there?
Oh, boy. This was a fork in the road that I never saw coming. My daughter bought me for Christmas this book called Secret Knowledge by the painter David Hockney, where he basically said artists in the late Renaissance were using optical devices to paint. And it explains some of the characteristics of these paintings that are pretty mysterious otherwise. The book was very controversial. As I say, my daughter bought it for me for Christmas. I read the book, and in the bibliography of the book, he talks about another book called Vermeer's Camera. And Vermeer was a Dutch painter from the mid-17th century. And his pictures look very much like photographs. He only painted 35 or 40 pictures that we have, but they're all perfect. They're little jewels of realism. And I started to think about this and look at it. And the basic idea behind David Hockney and Philip Stedman's book, Vermeer's Camera, is that the painters were using a camera obscura, which is nothing but a dark box with a lens in the side, you know, pre-photography camera, essentially. And if you've ever seen a camera obscura, it's kind of a dim, kind of fuzzy image that's projected on the screen of the unit. But it's moving, you know, it's whatever's out there in front of the lens gets projected on this little screen. And people assumed that you could just paint on that projection. Well, you can't. It doesn't work, strangely enough. And I knew this. As soon as you start to paint on the screen, it obscures the projection. And you can't compare your painting to the screen. One obliterates the other. And I had been in Amsterdam at the IBC show, video show. And I'd gone to the Rijksmuseum and looked at these paintings. And in the bathtub, this idea just suddenly emerged from nowhere that if you could compare the painting to the camera projection, you could copy the colors perfectly. But you couldn't do it with the camera obscura alone. So mentally, I arranged this flat mirror small flat mirror out in space such that you could see the reflection of your subject in the mirror, and then off to the side of the mirror, you'd see your painting looking straight. Hard to describe, but the mirror's sort of at a 45-degree angle out in front of your nose. And you move your head back and forth, and you can see subject, painting, and you work until you've eliminated any difference between the two. And you can match the paint colors trivially easy. And I thought, that's interesting. I might be onto something here. So I started researching. I went on the internet looking for this idea. Surely somebody has come up with this before. Apparently not. About this time, I got an email from Penn Jillette in Las Vegas, and he said, hey, yep, I haven't seen you in a long time. I've been hanging out with my kids and not my friends, and I could use a sort of an adult conversation. Could you come out and visit? I said, sure, I'll come out next week. So we sat down for dinner, and he said, talk to me about something that's not show business and it's not politics. He said, I've had it up to here with show business today. What else can we talk about? And I said, well, you know about Vermeer? Yeah, he said, I went to that show in New York of all the Vermeers. It's amazing, you know, photoreal paintings. And he knew a fair amount about it. And I said, well, I think I figured out the optical technique that he used to make the pictures. He said, what are you talking about? And I explained the idea to him, and he immediately got it because magicians use similar techniques involving mirrors. You know, it's all done with mirrors. And Penn said, I get what you're talking about. What are you going to do with this? I said, well, I'll, you know, write a paper about it or maybe make a YouTube video. And he said, that is a really stupid idea. This should be a film. You should stop right now. Don't do anything else. And let me see if I can get somebody interested in this film. And that's how it started.
Like anything Penn and Teller are involved with, you know, a very fun documentary to watch as well. And it takes you to like Holland and the north coast of Yorkshire and Buckingham Palace even as well. So that is available if you want to check it out on streaming services and on Blu-ray as well. So I'll put a link to that in our show notes.
Yeah, amazingly successful film. You know, I'm way too close to the forest to see the trees. I asked Ben, who would watch this? And he said, people will watch it. And it was actually nominated for a BAFTA award. And got to go to the big BAFTA ceremony there in London.
Well, Tim, what are you up to these days?
Tim's Vermeer never stopped. Well, it actually stopped for a year or two. I didn't want to touch a paintbrush. I was sick of the whole thing, literally detested painting. And my daughters were home, three daughters, they were home for Christmas. And Claire, the youngest, had been the model in Tim's Vermeer. And I said, Claire, I want to try a very simple experiment with an extremely simple device, just a flat mirror. And I want to try to paint your face. We started working, and Claire was posing as Vermeer's girl with a pearl earring. And I was sitting right next to her with a mirror, just a single mirror, and copying her face on the canvas. And it started to work extremely well. After the first day, I had an incredible likeness of her face. You know, she had her head in a vise. She had to tighten this wood vise around her head so it would not move. Very uncomfortable. She could tolerate it for 20 minutes or so. Anyway, she agreed, and we finished the painting. I told Penn that I was doing this, and he said, well, by all means, run cameras. You know, we want to see if something interesting happens. Well, we ran cameras for years and years and years after that. That was started in 2015. I got invited to do an exhibit at an art museum in Australia called the Museum of Old and New Art in Hobart, Tasmania. And that exhibit ran for several years, and we filmed a lot of it. So things have been going in the can, as they say, from the camera, for years now. The Tim's Vermeer team has been working on it, and it's now starting to get close. It's down to a kind of a 4 or 5 hour rough edit at this point. And then at the same time, I'm writing what I call the magnum opus, the big book of optics and painting. And I've been working on that, you know, for 15 years now. It's also making good progress. That keeps me busy. I'm retired from New Tech. VizRT bought New Tech 3 years ago. So, like I say, the road I never expected. It's taken over my life.
Well, it's amazing to hear that, you know, the passion burns strong, Tim. It's been an absolute honor talking to you. So thank you so much for coming on and sharing some of your memories with us this week.
My pleasure, and thanks for your interest.